lot of people are afraid and saying that prisoners might be in jail longer due to the lack of access to cash bail. We don't see this helping the people that are already over-policed in black and brown communities, and there is a bias towards the people that end up there. So we just see this causing more restrictions and more friction on the inside. This doesn't look like the savior bill that we're supporting.
Amani Sawari, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Amani Sawari is a prison strike organizer working on behalf of Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, a network of prisoners who are helping to organize the nationwide prison strike. The strike began August 21st, the 47th anniversary of the killing of Black Panther George Jackson in San Quentin prison, and ends on September 9th, the 47th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising here in New York. That's it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
Tune in on Thursday, August 30th at 8 p.m. to celebrate the Native programmers and the Native community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Jack Malmstrom of Rose City Native Radio will host this special on-air program. You can join us at the Native Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 30th. More information about the Native Community Open House and the anniversary programming can be found at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. American Indian Day is a traditional showcase and celebration of American Indian and Alaskan Native cultures and community, which raises awareness concerning the challenges that Native American people face in this country. This event features vendors, educational booths, food, entertainment, and more. Again, that's Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 700 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. Hopworks beer is available on draft, in bottles, and in cans throughout the Northwest, also offering kegs to go. More information online at hopworksbeer.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, toxic algae makes a local lake unsafe for swimming.
Housing in Portland? Why a new plan to fix some of the problems is sparking new complaints.
And in international news, a man who brought a unique school for girls to Afghanistan has passed away here in Portland.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 30th, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Annette Newell. Health officials are warning that they found toxic blue-green algae in Vancouver Lake. The advisory is upgraded from a caution to a warning, and they're telling people to stay out of the water. The cyanotoxins in the algae can be deadly to small pets and children and cause rashes and nausea, illnesses vulnerable in people. Officials will announce when it's safe to swim in the lake again.
The Oregon Health Authority has lifted its advisory against water contact at Cannon Beach due to high levels of fecal bacteria. It had issued an advisory against swimming earlier this week. Advisories remain in effect, though, for the high bacterial levels at Agate and Nye Beach in Lincoln County and Harris Beach in Curry County. People should avoid direct contact with the water in the area because it can cause stomach cramps, skin rashes, and other illnesses.
United States Attorney for Oregon Billy J. Williams announces that six people are charged with interstate marijuana smuggling. The federal charges related to allegedly selling Oregon pot in Florida, Virginia, and Texas. Articles in Willamette Week say that the defendants were not licensed to sell marijuana in Oregon. The U.S. Attorney website says Jody Wafer, Trent Knight, and Brittany Kizzy, all of Houston, Texas, and Raleigh Lowe and Paul Eugene Thomas of Portland are accused of conspiring to manufacture marijuana in Portland and distributing it to Texas and Virginia. Federal agents seized guns and cash in the raids that resulted in the arrests. A federal civil complaint has been counted to confiscate the acreage used to grow the marijuana plants. The overproduction of marijuana in Oregon has led to speculation that smuggling is taking up some of that slack. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which regulates dope sales in Oregon, recently reduced the amount of marijuana that a medical card holder can buy from 24 ounces per day to just 1 ounce. The OLCC cited suspicions that the larger sales, which were largely coming from a handful of stores, were being sent out of our state. U.S. Attorney Williams said regarding the arrests, "These cases provide clear evidence of what I have repeatedly raised concerns over. Oregon's marijuana industry is attracting organized criminal networks looking to capitalize on the state's relaxed regulatory environment. Dismantling criminal organizations is a key focus of our marijuana enforcement strategy. We will continue to work with our federal, state, local, and tribal partners to disrupt overproduction and the illegal export of marijuana out of state."
Local religious leaders have again protested outside the immigration and enforcement facility in southwest Portland. The rally began at 10 a.m. when protesters marched from Elizabeth Caruthers Park to the ICE building on Southwest McAdam Avenue. They then held a prayer circle outside the facility's entrance. Their peaceful protest called for an end to immigrant detention. The Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice is asking ICE to release the asylum seekers who are being held at the Sheridan Federal Correction Institution and to end their contract with NorCorps facility in the Dalles. The faith leaders are also asking Oregon citizens to vote no on Measure 105, which would repeal the state's sanctuary law. This is just one of six similar rallies this month. Several people were detained by federal protective service agents at the protest. 2 weeks ago, officers arrested some faith leaders in front of the ICE building after they held hands to block the facility driveway.
Portland police arrest a man they say threatened a Portland woman with a knife, calling her racist and sexist names. Police arrested 33-year-old Joshua Castillo, who they accuse of a hate crime. They say he approached 63-year-old Janet Mack on Southwest Columbia Street and 12th Avenue on Monday afternoon. Mack says Castillo threatened to kill her and chop her up and called her the N-word and the B-word. Castillo faces charges including menacing, intimidation, and trespassing. Portland police encourage people who are victims or witnesses to hate crimes to call 911 and report them. They say the city is a partner with the group Portland United Against Hate.
The Portland Sustainability Committee started in 2010 and is responsible for the stewardship of the city's comprehensive plan, climate action plan, and zoning code. The council-appointed committee met this week to work on Mayor Wheeler's Residential Infill Project, or RIP. Wheeler's RIP proposal has drawn citizen complaints regarding housing equity and the openness of the process. KBOO's Joe Meyer is covering the story and filed this report.
Mayor Ted Wheeler's Planning Bureau is working on a new zoning project that potentially upzones all of Portland's residential neighborhoods. Who benefits from Wheeler's new housing plan? Does it address affordability? Will it lead to more teardowns? For city responses to these questions, I spoke with lead Portland planner Eric Engstrom.
My name is Eric Engstrom. I'm a principal planner with the City of Portland at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I manage the city's comprehensive planning program. It's a state mandate that we update our plans periodically, and the original one was adopted in 1980, and this was our biggest overhaul since then.
When did you first come across the missing middle housing concept?
We initially were not using the term in our plan. We didn't start formally using that term until probably 2015. Advocates who are interested in housing choice and housing variety introduced the term to the process, and so we sort of felt that in order to respond to that testimony that we had to use the term, and it calls for us to look towards greater utilization of middle housing in the future and to consider zoning changes in the future to accommodate more middle housing.
In that context, what does middle housing mean?
It means things like duplexes or triplexes, fourplexes, cottages in backyards. It's really anything that's kind of in that middle between. If you think about apartment buildings on the one end of the spectrum, and Portland has accommodated a big share of our growth in recent years in 4 or 5 story apartment buildings, and so that's multifamily housing, and then you have larger lot single family housing on the other end of the spectrum. And I think the term middle housing is designed to capture the types of housing that maybe fall halfway between those two housing forms.
And why is this good for Portland?
A core function of land use planning is to ensure we have enough land for anticipated growth over the next 20 years. And under Oregon law, we not only have to look at the pure numbers of how many units we can accommodate, but we're also supposed to look at the types of units and make sure that lines up with expected incomes and family sizes and things like that. We know from a lot of both testimony and analysis that, you know, that housing costs are rising, and we have a concern that not everyone's going to be able to afford a traditional single-family house going forward. And so we're looking for ways of expanding housing options for the period of the comprehensive plan over the next 20 years.
Are there downsides to the middle housing policy?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess the one downside is it's change, and change can be hard, and it requires some dialogue.
Does the middle housing policy address affordable housing?
It was not directly aimed at affordable housing. It was more aimed at housing choice and housing types, although I think it has an effect on affordability in the sense that if we have an inadequate supply of housing, if our zoning doesn't allow enough housing, that can cause the price to go up. But the real aim of middle housing, I think, was to look at housing choice of, in terms of size and type of unit. And it affects affordability in the sense that it allows more housing in the city to be built in general.
Sometimes when you say choice, that means free market. Would you consider this a free market reform?
In some ways, I mean, there's a great demand for housing in the inner neighborhoods of Portland. You see a huge number of, as I mentioned, apartment buildings being built, and that's the place also where we've seen the most accessory dwelling units or the backyard cottages. So essentially, this is responding to that intense market demand and trying to create some space for additional infill in those high-demand neighborhoods.
What do you think is driving the middle house policy politically? Is there a champion at City Hall?
The first city commissioner to bring it up was Commissioner Novick, who's no longer on the council. But the several members of the current council were on the council when they adopted the comprehensive plan, including Commissioner Saltzman and Fritz. It's been discussed by folks who are in Fish. It's been discussed by current members of City Council. Mayor Wheeler has generally supported it, I believe, and has been engaged in the residential infill project. So I think it still has champions and is something that folks, a segment of the community has been asking for.
Without the residential infill project, could we still accommodate the expected number of people moving to Portland?
In pure numbers terms, yeah. This isn't really about hitting our numbers. The plan anticipated around 123,000 households that would be that the city would grow by that amount in the next 20 years, and we can accommodate that number of people without the RIP project. But again, it's a question of whether we've got the right match between the type of households that we're going to have and their financial resources and the type of housing we can provide.
So if we were going to build more housing for people coming up from floods in Louisiana, it would be of a different style than people coming from California?
I don't know. Maybe. This The middle housing basically creates more choice in housing form, so it makes us more flexible in terms of the types of housing people can seek here.
Will RIP increase the demolition of Portland housing, and especially the demolition of affordable housing?
I think the question of whether this is going to increase demolition and where is a key question, and it's something that we've been looking at. I don't have a clear answer to that yet. I think our initial analysis on our initial proposal didn't think we would be increasing demolition, and we're going to have to update that analysis when we get the Planning Commission's recommendation.
Is it likely that the lower cost houses will go first?
The place that would be most, I think, at risk would be the places where there are houses that are worth relatively lower values compared to the land value.
Is it likely if there are lower cost houses that people who are renting there would be paying low rent?
That's another factor is that we've looked at in terms of an equity analysis is, does this differentially impact renters versus homeowners, and in what ways, or does it impact communities of color differently than other communities? And that's part of the analysis we've been trying to do. We don't have a clear answer yet, but that's a legitimate question.
The middle housing policy is yet another housing policy that will benefit the largely white middle class.
I don't think that's necessarily true. To the extent that it adds housing variety and choice, that it potentially adds diversity and it potentially breaks down the exclusivity of some neighborhoods. So I think we're looking at it as a way to add choice.
The public was not adequately notified. Middle housing policy was introduced as a last-minute amendment in a multi-year process.
It was a multi-year process. It was an amendment. The policy that we're talking about was an amendment in the last segment of the process. But City Council, when they receive a proposal, part of the legislative process is they get to listen to testimony, they hold hearings, and they get to make amendments based on what they hear about that. So the idea that somehow adding a policy at the council level is a process foul, that doesn't hold water. That's inherent in the legislative process, that council gets to change what they see in front of them and make amendments. Sometimes an argument made by a couple people can outweigh an argument made by a lot of people. It's about the facts and information that council has and what they decide is the right thing to do.
That was Mayor Wheeler's Bureau of Planning lead planner, Eric Engstrom. According to Mr. Engstrom, Portland is required to plan not only for the number of people moving to Portland, but also their housing market expectations. Mayor Wheeler's residential infill project emphasizes choice and free market solutions to Portland housing. Although middle housing does not directly address affordable housing, some trickle-down effects can be imagined. Finally, Mr. Engstrom told us that the Planning Bureau is working to understand how the residential infill project will affect communities of color, increase pressures on teardown, and address issues of economic equality. The next planning meeting is September 11th, 12:30 to 3:30 at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Do you dream of heading up your own nonprofit that celebrates arts or heritage? This might be your chance. The Multnomah County Cultural Coalition has opened up a grant cycle this week. They're offering awards of as much as $2,000 for not-for-profit arts and heritage groups that help cultivate our community. To find out more, you can go to informational sessions that are starting on Monday, September the 10th at the Hollywood Senior Center in Portland from 6 to 8 p.m. There are also some sessions coming up later this month at Tabor Space and Park Place Cafe in Southeast Portland. You can also head online to check it out at multcoculturalcoalition.org. The deadline to apply is October 5th. Since 2003, the Multnomah County Cultural Coalition has been championing the enrichment of people who live in Multnomah County. They helped pay for things like art classes, performing arts centers, and tribal traditions, in all supporting 1,400 groups in Oregon.
Ted Achilles, who helped start a boarding school for girls in Afghanistan, has died in a hospice in Portland. He was 82 years old. The cause was complications from prostate cancer. Achilles moved to Afghanistan after the U.S. invaded in 2001. He spent more than a decade trying to improve the education available there. In 2004, he became the director of a youth exchange and study program that sent promising high school students to the U.S. He and others hoped the students would go back to their native Afghanistan and become leaders there, but many refused to go back and sought asylum in Canada. As the New York Times notes this week, later on, Achilles focused on bettering education for girls, who were not legally allowed to attend school since 1996 when the Taliban took over the country. Although that's changed since the U.S. occupation began, many girls still face threats of harassment for going to school. Achilles and others he worked with started the School of Leadership in Afghanistan, securing more than $10 million in scholarships. The boarding school in Kabul had its first classes in 2016 and has 70 full-time students. Its first class will graduate in 2022. Ted Achilles served on its board of trustees up until his death this week. In 1975, he became the chief executive of Morrow Electronics in Salem. He served two terms in the Oregon legislature.
Climate Connections is a daily piece that shows how climate change is already affecting our lives and what we can do about it. On today's episode, we hear about one of the country's oldest wind farms.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. On the rolling hills of Altamont Pass, east of San Francisco, one of the country's oldest wind farms has produced power for more than 30 years. There, almost 1,500 old turbines were taken down in recent years. Only 82 new ones were installed in their place, but they produce about the same amount of electricity. Celeste Warner is with the American Wind Energy Association.
The U.S. wind industry has seen significant advances in technology in just the last 10 years. Using longer blades and taller towers makes the turbine able to access stronger, steadier winds.
Warner says that as technology improves, many old wind farms are upgrading their systems. Some simply replace components like rotors and blades. Others get new turbines altogether.
Doing these upgrades can really give new life to a wind farm and increase the annual energy production.
She says these improvements have helped make wind power more affordable. And that's helping the industry grow and add more clean energy to the grid. Over the past decade, wind power generation in the U.S. has tripled.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Black History 365 celebrates Black achievements and honors Black history for every day of the year. In today's episode, we go to the year 1967.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is August 30th, and on this day, in 1967, Thurgood Marshall was confirmed as the first African-American Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. He was the 96th Justice and served from 1967 to 1991. Justice Marshall's confirmation heavily contributed to the Civil Rights Revolution in the 20th century.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
And now it's time for today's Labor History in Two from Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day labor leader Luisa Moreno was born in Guatemala City. As a young woman, she fought for the admission of women into Guatemalan universities. After attending journalism school in Mexico City, Luisa moved to New York with her husband and worked as a seamstress. Outraged by low pay, racial discrimination, and poor working conditions, she led organizing efforts on the job. During the Great Depression, she worked as a full-time union organizer, first with the AFL, organizing Black and Latina cigar rollers in Florida. But she also became active with the Communist Party and joined CIO efforts to organize cannery workers. Luisa led unionizing efforts of pecan shelling women workers in San Antonio, Texas, and then of cannery workers in Los Angeles. In 1938, Luisa helped organize the Spanish-speaking People's Congress. During World War II, she fought against discrimination in hiring of Mexicans in oil and war-related industries. In the 1940s, she became centrally involved in high-profile legal defense cases of Mexican-American youth prosecuted on frame-up charges. These included work around the 1942 Sleepy Lagoon case and then of victims of the Zoot Suit riots a year later. She continued union work in California, helping to organize and represent walnut pickers. By 1950, she was caught in the crosshairs of the McCarthy-era witch hunts. Luisa was targeted by Operation Wetback and offered citizenship status in return for testimony against radical labor leader Harry Bridges. When she refused, she faced deportation on the accusation that she had once been a member of the Communist Party. She returned to Guatemala and continued organizing workers throughout Central America. Luisa Moreno died in Guatemala in 1992. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that aims to keep the news honest. On today's episode, more on the Mueller investigation, Nebraska is trying to deny trans people rights, and how the media is still so white.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, August 30th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Special Counsel Robert Mueller wants to review emails between Paul Manafort and one of his former lawyers. Also on the nationwide rundown, Nebraska leads an effort to deny trans workers job protections, plus some perspective on why the mainstream news media is still so white. First, our top story, Political Reporting Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team wants to review emails between Paul Manafort and one of his former lawyers, messages that would typically be protected by attorney-client privilege. Mueller's team argued in a court motion Wednesday, attorney-client privilege does not apply when the client enlists a lawyer to help commit a crime. Politico notes a federal judge ruled last year that the lawyer, who had responded to inquiries from the Justice Department about why Manafort and Gates had not registered as foreign agents, could be forced to testify in Manafort's trial. A group of 16 states led by Nebraska has filed an amicus brief urging the U.S. Supreme Court to confirm that businesses can fire people just for being transgender.
States want to reverse an appeals court ruling that a funeral home in Michigan discriminated against a worker who transitioned during employment. Danielle Conrad with the ACLU of Nebraska says it's clear that the termination was made because of arbitrary factors, not based on job performance.
We strongly believe that Attorney General Doug Peterson does not speak for all Nebraskans who are, in fact, fair-minded. And so we really feel that this effort is out of step with Nebraska values.
The states claim that gender identity is a completely different concept from sex and argue the lower court was wrong to rule that identity is protected under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, a federal law that prohibits employers from discrimination based on sex, race, color, national origin, and religion. I'm Eric Galatas.
Missouri's agriculture products bring in more than $88 billion a year based on the latest data from the Missouri Farm Bureau, and much of that labor is supplied by migrant workers on H-2A visas. Stephanie Carson has more in a lawsuit alleging protections for workers are not being upheld by the Department of Labor.
The visas allow foreign nationals to enter the U.S. for temporary work, and by law must meet certain stipulations about wages and working conditions. A lawsuit filed this week by the Farm Labor Organizing Committee alleges that requirement is not being enforced by the U.S. Department of Labor in Missouri and other states. Justin Flores with Flock explains the implications.
So what that leads to is just workers being paid less, both guest workers coming from Mexico and other countries, as well as U.S. workers that are working in those jobs.
The U.S. Department of Labor referred a request for comment to the Department of Justice, who declined to comment on this story.
Conservation advocates say it's now or never to protect the aquifer underneath the Mojave Trails National Monument in Southern California.
The state legislative session ends tomorrow, so supporters are urging state lawmakers to pass Senate Bill 120. It would require the controversial Cadiz Water Project to undergo state review, even as the Trump administration has moved to fast-track it. David Lamfrom with the National Parks Conservation Association says the plan to transfer desert water to seven Southern California cities is flawed.
New science indicates that this project would drain
14 billion gallons of water per year from an ancient aquifer, which feeds desert springs, which are critical for native culture, for wildlife in the region, and for our national parks and our national monuments.
The Trump administration has decided a federal review is unnecessary for the Cadiz project, and the developer maintains it would not harm the aquifer and would create jobs. I'm Suzanne Potter.
As summer comes to a close, experts are saying this season has shown that climate change is having a serious impact in states like Nevada. July was the hottest month ever recorded for the city of Reno, 14 days over 100 degrees. Scott McGuire is with the National Weather Service in Reno. He says since the year 2000, there's been an obvious warming trend in the region.
We've only set two record lows in the last 18 and a half years. Actually, we didn't even set them. We just tied them. And we've set or tied over 170 record highs. So that's a pretty big change that's happening here.
A report this month from the National Wildlife Federation highlights the toll that the warming climate is taking on summer recreation nationwide. Lake Tahoe, usually known for its cold mountain water, reached some of its highest recorded temperatures in July at over 70 degrees. Finally, Ross Brown tells us the story of America is becoming increasingly more diverse, but the same can't be said for America's storytellers, also known as news reporters.
While the population of the United States is nearly 40% non-white and growing, 83% of journalists working in U.S. newsrooms are white. To be fair, newsrooms were getting much more diverse until about 2008, when the economy crashed, forcing massive layoffs. That meant the last hired were the first to go, including many minorities. At the same time, because the way people get their news has changed so dramatically, newsrooms have continued to shrink. Rick Harp creates podcasts for Media Indigena. He says many people's stories are not being told, or they're framed through the lens of a white journalist, often male.
And I think sometimes even if you're not a white man, you tend to adopt their perspective on things. It becomes the norm, and people start to internalize that, even if you're an indigenous reporter.
The Kerner Commission released the first report on the lack of diversity in newsrooms back in 1968, calling attention to the issue during reporting on the civil rights movement. I'm Mike Clifford. You've been newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a court ruling against the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project. At 6, it's Rose Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Indigenous Power. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of around 59 degrees, followed by more cloudy weather and a high in the mid-70s. Today in history, Anna Politkovskaya was born in 1958. Politkovskaya took on such powerful forces as the Putin government and the pro-Russian regime during the Chechen War. Her truly heroic efforts at uncovering deep corruption and horrific human rights violations earned her a book deal and a bullseye. She was said to be constantly fearing for her life. She was subjected to a mock execution and an attack via poisonous tea. She was found shot at point blank in the elevator of her apartment block on October 7th in 2006. Her colleague stated of her that frontline soldiers do not usually go into battle so often and survive. And our quote of the day is from author John Irving. In the world according to Garp, we are all terminal cases.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, a federal court has rejected the government's approval of the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project, the CBC reports, leaving it in limbo. The pipeline by U.S.-based Kinder Morgan would triple the amount of oil flowing from Alberta to the U.S. West Coast to be shipped by tanker overseas. Native groups in both the U.S. and Canada have been fighting the pipeline, but some First Nations approve it, seeing it as creating jobs and boosting the economy. Native people in Arizona were among those to visit the Arizona State Capitol Wednesday to pay respect to U.S. Senator John McCain, who died last weekend after battling cancer. Tribal leaders are expected to be among those in attendance at a memorial service Thursday in Phoenix among federal, state, and local officials. McCain is being remembered as a pioneer in Indian gaming and for his years-long work on Indian country issues. Among pallbearers is U.S. District Court Judge Diane Humitiwa, who's Hopi, and a former U.S. attorney. In 2014, McCain nominated her to serve as a federal judge. After her confirmation, Humitiwa made history, becoming the first Native American woman on the federal bench. Healthcare can be hard to access in rural communities and even more difficult when facilities are not tailored to a community's specific needs, especially among tribes. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner has more.
A recently published paper argues that more self-determination and frank discussions about structural racism could help improve access to healthcare for Indigenous populations. Marshall Chin is a co-author on the paper and an expert in healthcare disparities at the University of Chicago Medicine.
It's important for us to have honest discussions as a country about history, about colonialism, about why we're in the situation now where tribes have significant health challenges and economic challenges.
Comparing 11 Western countries, the Commonwealth Fund found in 2017 that New Zealand ranked 8th, while the United States ranked 11th in health equity. Co-author and Maori tribal member from the Ngati Kahungunu Iwi, Brian Jones, says that health disparities are greatly reduced if Indigenous communities are given more control over their healthcare systems.
The more authentically Indigenous communities were afforded the ability to determine how services were run, the more successful those initiatives were.
Jones says the people making the decisions about Indigenous healthcare are often not Indigenous themselves, and that the decision makers can sometimes be out of touch with the day-to-day needs of Indigenous communities.
We do find ourselves in a situation where we're often making decisions which work really well for our dominant culture, for our white culture. Those decisions are generally made by often doctors making decisions that work really well for their people, and those decisions fail Indigenous population groups.
Both Chin and Jones hope the paper sheds light on the issue of healthcare inequity for Indigenous people around the globe. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner in Laramie.
A celebration of Native American and Hispanic culture in Santa Fe, New Mexico, will aim to reconcile relations after the recent cancellation of a controversial reenactment of Spanish conquistadors taking over the city. Native people who protested the annual entrada said it highlighted genocide. The Associated Press reports under the new plan, Santa Fe will kick off celebrations next week, which will continue through Indigenous Peoples Day in October. Campgrounds in a world-renowned area at the bottom of the Grand Canyon are expected to reopen this weekend. The Havasupai tribe closed its campgrounds and declared a state of emergency in July after waves hit the community, causing damage and mud and rock slides. Recovery efforts from the flood are in the thousands of dollars. The tribe's primary source of revenue is from people who travel to the reservation to see its blue-green waterfalls. The tribe says repairs have been completed and the area is safe for visitors. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
It's a victory for quarterback Colin Kaepernick and a setback for the NFL. The New York Times reports an arbitrator decided the football player's lawyers have found enough evidence for his case to proceed. Kaepernick says the league and its owners colluded to keep him off the field. He filed a grievance against the NFL in October, accusing the owners of conspiring to not give him a new contract because of his decision to protest during the playing of the national anthem. In 2016, Kaepernick was the first player to kneel during the anthem to raise awareness about police brutality and social injustice. Dozens of other players ended up joining him. That created tensions with some fans, sponsors, and owners. President Trump attacked the NFL for not penalizing players who did not stand for the anthem. In May, the league tightened its policy, forcing players to stand for the anthem. Kaepernick played 6 years with the 49ers and led them to the Super Bowl in his second season. Since he became a free agent in March of 2017, he has not been invited to work out for a team or offered a new contract.
President Donald Trump announced today that he is canceling pay raises for most federal employees. The pay increases would have started in January. Trump cited government budget concerns as the reason for the suspension. In a letter to the congressional leaders, Trump wrote, quote, "I have determined that for 2019, both across-the-board pay increases and locality pay increases will be set at zero." We must maintain efforts to put our nation on a fiscally sustainable course, and federal agency budgets cannot sustain such increases, end quote. The proposed raises were set at 25.7% for localities and 2.1% for across-the-board pay. Under federal law, employees get cost-of-living raises every year, unless the president determines the raises are not feasible. Trump argues the increases would add billions of dollars to the federal deficit. The move to stop the pay increases comes months after Trump approved a $1.5 trillion tax cut for corporations and the wealthy. This is in addition to a $1.3 trillion spending bill. The Congressional Budget Office expects the combined effect will increase the government's budget deficit $1 trillion next year. The president of the National Treasury Employees Union, Tony Reardon, said the move to suspend pay increases shows that the Trump administration, quote, simply does not respect its own workforce.
The New York Times reports that three current or former employees at the Philadelphia Insectarium and Butterfly Pavilion are being accused of stealing about $40,000 worth of insects and lizards. An estimated 7,000 animals, or about 80% to 90% of the populations in the insectarium, were stolen on August 22nd and probably some other days. The police contacted the suspects and are looking through their homes in hopes of finding the insects. They also wrote that security cameras around the pavilion recorded several people creeping out of the museum last week with plastic containers holding giant African mantises, bumblebee millipedes, warty glow spot roaches, tarantulas, dwarfs and tiger hissers, and leopard geckos. The desert hairy scorpions and domino cockroaches had also disappeared. They said the staff uniforms were hung with knives that they stabbed onto the walls of the building. John Cambridge, the chief executive of the Insectarium, told the New York Times he believed that someone recognized an opportunity to remove some creatures and did it. There have been no arrests yet. I really don't think the perpetrators realized the severity of what they were doing, Cambridge added. We believe that they were taken for the purpose of resale. The police returned a large amount of insects and a Mexican fire-legged tarantula to the insectarium, but one of the most venomous six-eyed spiders in the world is still missing. We are going to be able to use this as a learning opportunity to build an even better insectarium, Dr. Cambridge said. We just want our critters back.
South Korea has banned the sale of coffee in schools, even for teachers, in order to promote healthier lifestyles among children. The move is part of a wider government campaign to reduce the consumption of food and drink that is high in caffeine and calories. The ban will go into effect September 14th and will restrict coffee sales in primary and secondary schools across the country. The sale of other beverages with high levels of caffeine, such as energy drinks, is already banned in South Korean schools. An official from the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety said, quote, the revision aims to create healthy eating habits among children and teenagers. According to the International Coffee Organization, in 2016, South Koreans consumed 2.3 kilograms of coffee per person. While the figure is only roughly half the amount consumed in the United States, it is one of the highest among Asian countries. Similarly, the number of coffee shops in South Korea tripled from around 12,000 in 2011 to over 49,000 in 2015. Critics of the plan note that the students can still walk a few blocks from their school campuses in order to purchase coffee and other caffeinated drinks.
The nation of Vietnam has joined the line as Monsanto Corporation, now owned by Bayer, is facing 8,000 lawsuits worldwide over the toxic effects of its products. Monsanto manufactured Agent Orange, which was advertised as a safe defoliant and sprayed over millions of acres of Vietnamese rainforest in the 1960s and 1970s. 12 million gallons of dioxin-contaminated Agent Orange were used, resulting in injuries to 3 million Vietnamese and through genetic birth defects to their descendants. Bayer Corporation's stock has dropped precipitously since Monsanto lost a $289 million judgment over the cancer-causing effects of its product Roundup. Environmental advocates are also taking the corporation to court over the sale of its weed killer, Xtendimax, at a federal appeals court in Seattle. Xtendimax is Monsanto's answer to weeds that have evolved a resistance to its product Roundup. But the new product has a habit of vaporizing off the treated plants and then contaminating and damaging nearby trees and fields. The newer project is part of Monsanto's strategy to force sales of herbicide-resistant seeds. Asked about Bayer's response to the groundswell of lawsuits, Bayer's chief executive, Varner Bowman, said, "We will vigorously defend the case and all upcoming cases."
A dam in Myanmar has burst and flooded 85 villages, forcing over 63,000 people from their homes. The dam broke at Swar Creek in central Myanmar, flooding the nearby towns of Swar, Yeydash, as well as many neighboring villages. The water also submerged a section of highway and damaged a bridge between the major cities of Yangon, Mandalay, and the capital of Naypyidaw. The collapse was caused by heavy monsoon rains in the Bago region. The floodwaters have already begun to recede. However, two people remain missing. The Myanmar government has launched a rescue effort mission in response. Deputy Administrator Ye Dash Min Thu said, quote, "People whose villages are on high ground are preparing to go back to their villages. Work has already begun to repair the dam. The current priority is to get as much water back into the reservoir as is needed for irrigation during the dry season."
Venezuela and Colombia have been experiencing some heavy rainfall over the last week, causing extensive river flooding. Two are reported dead and more than 14,000 families are affected, particularly in Guainia, Vichada, Monagas, Amazonas, and Bolivar provinces. The Venezuelan government reports that the Orinoco River has swollen to an historic level and flooded Puerto Ayacucho. The Venezuelan Interior Minister has arranged to airlift to bring in supplies. Forecasters expect more thunderstorms today and tomorrow.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 30th. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, Joe Meyer, Lucas Campbell, and Annette Newell. The producer is Grace Ann Smith, and our engineer is Mike Fitaklis. The interim directors of the Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Annette Newell. Coming up tomorrow morning here on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani takes your calls. At 9, Rising Up with Somali looks at the growth of the Democratic Socialists of America and the new documentary, American Socialists, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs. At 10, Valley Views visits with the director of the Corvallis Benton County Public Library and looks at new ways they're connecting people and information. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Mr. Jones' Neighborhood looks back on the history of the Fire Sign Theater and the Mark Time Awards. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
For tonight's in-depth report, KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu talked with the Greenpeace Canada spokesperson Mike Hudema. Earlier today, a Canadian federal appeals court overturned the approval of the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion project. The appeals court found that the government failed to engage in meaningful discussion with First Nations before approving of the project. It did not take into account all environmental impacts.
This is KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu speaking with Mike Hudema, spokesperson for Greenpeace Canada. So we just have some questions about the Trans Mountain Pipeline project, the decision that was given out today. Can you explain to our listeners what the Trans Mountain Pipeline project is?
Well, the Trans Mountain Pipeline project is a massive tar sands pipeline that would run between the province of Alberta to the province of British Columbia. On its way, it would cross through a national park. It would cross over 1,000 streams and rivers, of course, endangering them all with threats of a spill. It would cross through the territory of several different Indigenous nations that have never consented to this project. And then it would eventually come out just south of Vancouver, where it would bring over 400 tankers up and down the west coast of British Columbia. And then down past Washington, Oregon, eventually to refineries in California, of course, posing spill risks to all the communities and economies along its way. So it's a pretty devastating project, but we won a pretty major victory against it today.
And what was the reaction when the project was first approved in 2016?
I think a lot of shock and disbelief. You know, there's a huge number of reasons to oppose this project, and whether you're talking about the impacts to climate change and, of course, the global climate crisis that we've seen some of the effects of this summer for sure, to the impacts on wildlife, to the fact that there is no indigenous consent to this project. You know, the reasons to say no to this project are fairly endless, and the fact that the Canadian government approved it despite those concerns, I think, shocked a lot of us.
So can you explain why the Federal Court of Appeals overturned the approval?
Yeah, so today the Federal Court of Appeal basically overturned the approval of this project because they found that the federal government completely failed in their legal duty to consult and accommodate the wishes of different Indigenous nations that were impacted by this project. They also found that this project completely failed to recognize the impact that these tankers would have on the endangered southern killer whale population, and failed to look at any measures or really do any research on what the impacts of this project would be on them. And so they've squashed this approval completely. And really, this means, you know, a quite significant delay for the project. And we hope it's a moment that gives the federal government enough time to reconsider and hopefully walk away from this project once and for all.
So do you think this is just going to be a delay in the project, or do you foresee a complete cancellation?
Well, right now I'd say that this project is dead. You know, we're really talking about a significant delay to a pipeline project that has already been delayed significantly. And so with every delay means mounting costs and mounting risks. You know, there is no clear path forward for this pipeline. The Indigenous nations along the route have been very clear that they've already studied the impacts of this project and that it doesn't meet their threshold for consent. And I doubt that the federal government is going to make them change their mind. And so while we need to remain vigilant and ensure that it doesn't move forward, this is a pretty big blow that was dealt today.
So how have Greenpeace Canada and other organizations worked to actually stop the project from going forward?
Well, you know, this is a fight that we've been fighting for over 8 years now, and we've really followed the leadership of Indigenous nations who have, you know, really been the true leaders, and this is, you know, first and foremost their victory today. And so we've tried to follow their leadership. We've also, of course, put our own bodies in the line to try and stop this project. Just recently, hanging off a bridge for over 38 hours to stop the tankers that are already moving associated with part of this project. You know, that fight is going to continue moving forward, but we hope that the load's going to get a lot less with today's victory.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the bridge protest?
For sure. So there are tankers already moving from the project that, you know, this new proposal would significantly expand and would actually build an entirely new pipeline. But there is already a pipeline that is bringing tar sands bitumen from Alberta to BC that is being loaded into tankers and, of course, already endangering the West Coast. And so a few weeks ago, myself and 12 other people climbed one of the bridges just out of Vancouver in the city of Burnaby
We descended from that bridge with huge aerial banners that each of which were designed by different indigenous artists and indigenous nations that have led the opposition to this project. And we were there blockading any tanker from moving in and out of Kinder Morgan's port for over 38 hours until we were removed by authorities.
What would you say was the government and then the public reaction to that protest?
I think the government reaction to it, of course, was that, I think the government has tried consistently to try and quell the growing protests against this project. And, already almost 250 people have been arrested standing against this project. And, of course, I don't think the government likes any of those arrests happening because it brings more attention to the threats and the dangers that this project poses. But the public reaction to our action was, a lot warmer. I think a lot of people were inspired by what we did. I think it was a really beautiful protest, especially having those indigenous artists' flags hanging above us. And I think it, showed some of the lengths of what people were willing to do to protect the places that they love. And it was just sort of one more moment in this really historic fight to protect this place. And that's why we're fighting so hard and why today's victory means so much.
What do you think Prime Minister Trudeau's reaction should be to this court decision?
Well, I think his reaction should be that, this should be the last reason he needs to turn away from this project once and for all. Buying this pipeline for $4.5 billion, which is what the Prime Minister is considering, all using taxpayer-funded money, isn't climate leadership. It isn't what Justin Trudeau promised to the world. And it isn't the type of policy that he should be engaging in for the good of Canada or the good of the planet, frankly. And so we hope that this is the last reason he needs to turn away from this project and start building the clean energy future that we all need to see.
And so do you see a better use of the funding within the renewable energy sector?
For sure. $4.5 billion would be a huge boost to clean energy growth and, of course, clean energy jobs right across the country. And so that money could be put forward to doing just that, to leading the world in clean energy development. But it could also be put to a lot of other uses, including ensuring every First Nation in Canada has clean drinking water. There are a lot of problems that we're facing right now, and throwing $4.5 billion towards a failing pipeline is the last thing that we should be doing.
And what do you think about the Finance Minister Bill Morneau's pledge to go ahead with the purchase of the project?
Well, it's pretty shocking. We're talking about, $4.5 billion just buys sort of the pipeline. It doesn't include the construction costs, which are now starting to mount around, in the area of $10 billion to try and construct this project. And that's without today's court decision, without the significant delays and costs that it will mean. And so this is a hugely expensive gamble that Bill Morneau is threatening to do, and we're hoping to apply a lot of last minute pressure to try to get him to change his mind, and this court decision provides him the opportunity to do just that.
How exactly are you planning on applying pressure?
So right now we've launched a petition, and then we're also asking all our members and members of the general public to call the Prime Minister and to try to pressure them to change his mind. And so we're doing that. A number of other organizations that, of course, have been part of this fight are also doing the same thing. And so we're trying to make sure that the Prime Minister hears from people across the country, and I would say, across the planet about this project, and hopefully that last-minute pressure will be what we need to solidify this victory, and if not, we'll be there to confront this pipeline if it ever moves forward.
And do you know what the general public's view is of the pipeline? Are they supportive or not really?
I would say, like, the view of the overall public is mixed. And so there are people that see or have bought into the economic benefits that the federal government has touted around this pipeline. But at the same time, if you ask people, you know, do they think that we should be investing in renewable energy, they will say yes. If you ask them, do you think we should live up to our climate commitments as the Prime Minister promised in Paris, they'll also say yes. And both of those things are impossible if you're putting $4.5 billion towards buying a clean, dirty energy project that pushes all those commitments out of reach.
And so you plan to keep fighting if the project does continue?
Yes, absolutely. And I think we plan on keep fighting, but I think all the nations who were in court today, I think that they're planning to keep fighting too. Because again, you know, we're fighting because we care about this place, because we care about the commitments that the Prime Minister made to Indigenous reconciliation and to climate action, because we care about protecting the coastline and the economies and communities that depend on it, and we care about respecting Indigenous rights. And this pipeline project expansion threatens all those things. And so, anytime it tries to move forward, yes, we'll be there. We've been there every step of the way fighting this project, and we'll continue to do just that if the Prime Minister makes the wrong decision on this one.
And do you know what the reaction was amongst the Indigenous nations towards the court decision?
The nations that were in court were definitely ecstatic. I think they see this as a huge victory and a huge vindication of what they've been saying all along. The Tsleil Waututh Nation alone, undertook a very thorough process to look at the impacts of this pipeline and trying to weigh whether it was in the best interest of their community or not. And the end result was that this wasn't in the best interest of their community, and they expected the Prime Minister to respect that. And today the court vindicated part of that.
This has been KABU reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu speaking with Mike Hudema, spokesperson for Greenpeace Canada.
The time is 6:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KABU is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KABU will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September